Welcome to Exploration 1, Module 8. Right, now we can get on with the usual stuff and talk about things. This morning we're going to talk about subnetting and binary to decimal conversion, and then we're going to talk about the physical layer, and we're going to talk about the remote bundle. Now, just for the purposes of the recording, the usernames and passwords for the workstations on the remote bundle are CAVI, C-A-V-I, as in Cisco Academy for the Vision Impaired, and CAVI for the password. Now, any other question? Has anybody seen, other than Drew, seen the one-minute video we put up on YouTube for CAVI?
No.
Didn't know there was one.
Yes. Well, that's an experience. You can, and good morning, Lucy, who I haven't said good morning to yet. You can do that. In fact, I'll post a link to it to the discuss list later on today. It's certainly an experience, and it's designed to try and net us a bit more funding. It's sort of an in 25 years style of video, where we all say things in 25 years, X, Y, Z, and I forgot my lines three times. So there you go. Kerry might be good at networking, but he's absolutely chronically bad at remembering lines, even if there's only three of them.
Should have had me do it. I'm a fantastic actor, and I have a brilliant Australian accent.
Yes, and you have an excellent sense of modesty and stuff. Okay, mm-hmm. we could certainly do that.
Now, I think my modesty is my greatest.
Absolutely. Second only to your sarcasm, of course. Okay. Right, so the remote bundle, we're talking about how to install TerraTerm first, actually. Now, what you do to install TerraTerm is you go to www.qcat.org and you go to Student Resources, and then you go to Extras, and you drag down the TerraTerm installer, and you install it accepting the defaults. You then go to, there's a JAWS script in the same directory, and you drag that JAWS script down, drop it into your JAWS scripting directory, and compile the script. Did anybody get that far with TerraTerm?
I didn't, but I will. I'm going to go get it as we speak.
I cheated. I already had it working.
Ah, excellent. Under general instructions, there's actually a file called tterm_notes.txt, which tells you exactly how to go through the procedure of setting TerraTerm up and exactly which settings you need to twiddle.
Yeah, got it set up and running.
Did it actually talk properly? Because the way you can tell whether that's working is when you Alt-Tab into the TerraTerm window, it should say File, Edit, View, Setup, Window, Help. And that tells you that the scripts are actually functional. And I stand corrected. I did a reorganization of the General Instructions folder. Okay. And under the General Instructions folder, there is now a folder called Networking. And in that Networking folder, there is actually a text file that explains to you exactly how to set up TerraTerm. I don't know. It really depends on the people. But I had thought about putting an audio tutorial on how to set up TerraTerm, but sometimes I just get sick of audio tutorial after audio tutorial after audio tutorial, and I figure that people can probably read a text file in 2.5 minutes rather than listen to a 15-minute walkthrough on how to get it installed and working. I don't know, is there any demand for a, chew your nails down audio tutorial for this, or do people prefer the documents?
Long with text files, I can go through them quicker.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not that I'm detracting from any of the amazing podcast resources out there, but there was a certain establishment that used to do podcasts. I won't say which establishment it was. With a certain fellow walking home from work with his dog, and 35 minutes later, I just wanted to find something else to do, and they hadn't even covered the actual topic that the podcast was supposedly about. And I'm just sort of a bit mindful of that and don't want to make things too verbose and tedious.
That version of TerraTerm isn't the latest one, by the way. They just came out with something a couple months ago.
Yes, I will grab the latest version and update that a little later today. It doesn't really make any difference to us,
yeah,
because version 2.3 would function just fine for everybody. Brian, of course, is using CRT, which is another terminal program. I haven't actually bought that because it costs money, and it just hadn't got to the top of my list of things to do. Although it is an excellent product, but yeah, TerraTerm is the free alternative that we've tended to use historically. Okay, so basically your basic procedure is you grab down the TerraTerm from extras, you install it accepting the default settings, you then grab the JAWS script and you uncompress the archive and you end up with a .jss file. Now you go to start and you find your current version of JAWS and you go explore my settings. You then paste the script file into your settings folder, the .jss, which if you're running under XP is C, documents and settings, user name, application data, Freedom Scientific, JAWS, version number, settings, ENU, if you're running ENU. And if you're running under Windows 7 and stuff, it's... What is it under Windows 7? Does anybody know? Where do the document file-y things, the top bit of the document file for users live? Where does percent user data percent point?
It's C users, username, app data, roaming. Freedom Scientific, JAWS.
Fair enough.
Version, ENU, settings, yeah, it's about 18 directories deep.
Well, there is actually a method in that madness because... historically, JAWS used to install itself into C program files, JAWS blah, and then it would dump all these scripts in and stuff. And the reason they actually isolated that out into sort of system-wide and user-specific settings was so that if you were using JAWS with roaming profiles, in theory, the scripts and stuff could come down with the roaming profile on login. I have no idea on practice how well that works.
It's pretty good because a lot of these group, a lot of organizations have app data as a directory on a server that the user actually has full write access to. And we used to have all kinds of problems with people who had JAWS, older versions, in work environments. And of course, typical user can't write to program files, so they couldn't make any changes.
Yeah, there are a lot of programs that expect to be able to make changes to the program files folders, and on a lot of network environments that's certainly not the case, and users are locked out from making changes to program files. So they've now made it so that you basically need to install the video intercept guffage and then you can drop the other stuff into various folders and stuff that aren't sort of locked down as hard as things like program files and those sorts of things. But the easiest way to get to that directory is to go start, all programs, JAWS, or if you go start under Windows 7 and put in the words explore my settings, will that get you there? I don't have Windows 7 in front of me to try, unfortunately.
Yeah, it does. That's how I did it.
Yeah, it does. I just tried it. It works. Now, the interesting thing is I always thought that Explorer Settings and Explore My Settings launched Explorer. It does not. It launches fsexplorer.exe, which won't run unless JAWS is running.
Oh, really? Didn't they write some FS Explorer thing so that everything could be standard in their training exercises or something? I remember being a bit mystified. Does everybody remember HJPad? Wasn't that just gorgeous?
Did anyone use
it? Never used it.
Well, it was written so that the text editing would be uniform across the versions of Windows that JAWS supported, and it was written in such a way that you wouldn't have any refresh or cursor up-down issues. Actually, which is an interesting point, has anybody else had a problem, and I will get on to the actual lecture content in a minute, where Notepad decides it's not reading the line you're cursoring up and down onto until you insert escape
many,
a couple of times
many,
and
many
do a dance around in three circles and, yeah.
Used to have it once upon a time, times, but no more.
Okay, I'll have to look at that. I have the problem under Windows XP, so much so that I resorted to using Word because it seemed to behave itself better, and that's a horrible thing to do. Okay, so you grab the script and you drop it into the Explore My Settings thing, which is under where we just previously spoke about. And then you, or you can browse to it by hand. You don't actually have to use the you don't actually have to use the Explore My Settings shortcut. It just happens to be there. And in fact, you can actually, if you like, if you're really, really clever, and you can't find it, you can actually dig up the key in the registry that points at the My Settings location and then find the path that way. But I wouldn't recommend that because registry editing is dangerous. You drop the JSS in there. You launch TerraTerm. You press Insert 0 to pull up the script manager, and you should have some script code, about three lines of it, in the script manager window. Let's just see if I'm making that up. Insert 0 or caps lock 0 or Jaws key 0. Oh, yes, you get this thing that says void function new text event, bracket handle window string. If get window blah 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 blah, and then once you've got that, you press Control S, which compiles the .jss into a .jsb, and that compiles it for the current user. Okay, it compiles it for the current user. You had a different experience. What experience did you have?
I copied the JSS and the JSB. So the moment I went into TerraTerm, it told me, this is an old version of the configuration, or something along those lines. Would you like to recompile? I said yes, and there I was.
Ah, well, I will now go and take the JSB out of the archive, because I'm a bit against distributing version-specific JSBs. But yes, that will also work. If you drop both files in, there is actually an old JSB in the archive. I don't know, it depends. Maybe it's easier if people just say yes to the recompile prompt. I had planned to make a 7-zip self-extractor or use the JSX installer that would drop the scripts into place, but I haven't found any good documentation on how to make that happen. Okay, so once you've got the script installed, you then need to go into TerraTerm and change some options. You need to go into... let me just open a connection to one of my hosts so I actually get the dialogue I want. Oh, no, that won't work. You go in and you have to change the cursor shape from the block to the vertical line or the horizontal line. And sometimes you have to reduce the number of lines on the screen, because what happens is when the cursor gets too close to the bottom of the screen, Jaws thinks it's in the taskbar even though it's not. And you may actually need to reduce the number of lines by about 3 or 4. This is especially true on netbooks that have a very small vertical resolution. A lot of netbooks are 1024 by 600, and you can't get 35 lines vertically on the screen unless you put an itsy-bitsy font on there. So I haven't actually found a way of stopping Jaws from getting confused, because it thinks that the cursor is in the area of the taskbar where, in fact, it's not. Alrighty. Now, so that's TerraTerm covered. So hopefully we'll have a couple more people who will have that installed and running, or be using their TerraTerm, their terminal of choice. Or if you happen to have a Linux box to hand, you can telnet from the command line of that Linux box, either by using SpeakUp or by using another solution. I tried Vinix the other day, and I had an interesting problem where a speech dispatcher fell over, and then the dummy module just kept telling me things and telling me to look at my log. I don't know whether anybody else has seen that with Vinix, but it's very frustrating because it's about 7 commands in and you're just getting into typing in the thing and it just dies horribly. So maybe that'll be fixed in a future version. Okie dokie. Looking at these binary to decimal exercises. We're only converting numbers from 1 to 255. There's a worked example. Do that, and then we convert the worked example back the other way to prove that we got it right. Okay, converting 37 to binary. We take the biggest power of 2, which is 32, and we put a 1. We take the next power of 2, which is 16, and we put a 0, because you can't subtract 16 from what we have left. You then take the next one, which is an 8, and you put a 0, so you get 1, 0, 0. You take off 4 from what you have left from 37 minus 32, which gives you 1 left, so then you put a 0, and then you get a 1. And I didn't actually have pegs in the board, so I don't actually know what that number was, but we get the idea. Anybody got any questions on the conversion process?
No.
Okie dokies. Now, what else have we got? There's a few more numbers that you have to convert, and I would like people to do them if they can. I have seen answers from a couple of people. I would like you all to prove to me that you really can do it. And then there's converting binary back the other way, which is where we add all of the powers of 2 that we have up and see what it converts to in decimal. So, for example, we've got 1110. So we look at that number and we say 0 times 2 to the power of 0. So we end up with 2 plus 4 plus 8, which happens to be 14, which is 1110. So that's how we convert back the other way. Everybody cool with that?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay, a subnet mask shows us how many bits belong to the network portion and how many bits belong to the host portion. I remember saying this a few times. The bits on the left are set to 1 and for the network portion, and the bits on the right are set to 0 for the host portion. Okay, 255.255.0.0. How many bits for network and how many bits for host? Can anybody tell me?
16
each.
Yep. Okay, 255.255.255.224. What do we got?
It's 24, right?
224 is 128 plus 64 plus 32. So by my reckoning, we've got 27 for network and 5 for host?
Right.
Yeah. Anybody confused with how I came to that answer? Anybody want me to try and clarify that?
Yeah.
255.255.255 means we have 8 lots of 1, 8 lots of 1, 8 lots of 1 for the network portion, so we have 24 ones on the left-hand side. Convert 224 to binary. 224, can we subtract 128? Yes, we can. So 224 minus 128 is... whips out the calculator... is 96. So we put a 1 down, we then subtract 64 and we get 32, so we put a 1 down, we then subtract 32 and we put a 1 down, so we end up with 8 lots of 1, 8 lots of 1, 8 lots of 1, 3 lots of 1, and then the rest of them is 0 0 0 0 0, because there are 5 zeros. So on the left-hand side, we have 27 ones and 5 zeros. We've basically converted the quantity 255.255.255.224 from decimal into binary and counted the number of ones on the left-hand side. Okay, 255.255.255.192. Does anybody want to have a shot at doing that one? And we won't laugh and point if you get it wrong, we promise.
210?
I don't know why you'd say 210. 255.255.255.192. How many bits for network and how many bits for host?
26 bits for network. And
6
bits for host.
That is absolutely correct. 192 in binary is 64 plus 128. So we have 255.255.255. We have 24 bits plus 2 more bits makes 26. 32 minus 26 is 6. So we have 26 and 6 bits for host. Spot question. If we have 6 bits for host, what is the maximum number of hosts we can have per subnet? Anybody want a refresher on how to do that?
It's 48, right?
Now, if you have 6 bits for host, 2 to the power 46. Of 6 is 64, minus 2 is 62, last time I checked.
Right.
2 to the power of h minus 2, where h is the number of host bits. So 2 to the power of 6 minus 2.
Yep.
Easy. Yep. Okay. Anybody having trouble with this? If you're getting the impression that I'm expecting you all to know how to do this by now, you'd be absolutely right. And if any of you don't know how to do this by now, maybe you guys need to catch me up on Skype or drop me some emails or something, because I'd really like to see people getting fluent at this and good at this. You can use the calculator for addition and subtraction. And if necessary and you don't have a power of 2 table, you can use the calculator to raise the 2 to the powers. So, in theory, math shouldn't be a problem. It's just a case of procedure. Okay. 255.255.240.0. Here's a tricky one. Anybody want to talk about this one? How you think you'd work this one out?
Well, you have, let's see, I'll give it a shot. You have 16 bits to start with. So then we do 240. We can take, I wish that thing would shut up. You can take 128 off it, which leaves you one something. Hang on, let me do that.
That leaves you with 112. I can do the subtractions one. For you. So...
112. We can take 64 off of that, so we have two more ones.
So we get 48.
Then we can take 32 off that, which leaves us 16.
That's right.
We can take 16, so that's another one, and then we have 8, 4, 2, and 0, with 4 zeros, so we have 30 bits for network and 4 for host.
Not quite.
No,
just let me
that
get
would
this
be
master.
No, 28 bits for network and 4 for host.
Now, it's actually 255.255.240.0, so what we would have is we would have 20 bits for network and 12 bits for host, because we've got 255.255 is 16 bits. We've got another 4 bits in the 240, which gets us to 20, and then we've got 12 bits for host. But that's an easy enough error to lose track of. There's a lot of thinky bits going on there. So 20 bits for network and 12 bits for host. Everybody happy with that answer? Or do you all think I'm making it up?
Nope, sounds right to me.
Sometimes I do make it up, and students catch me out. I should just warn you all that sometimes I get it very, very wrong, and people sort of have to go, oi. Now, there's a few more. There's one more there that we're not going to work through, because we're not going to do all the answers here. And I put a handy-dandy reference for Class A, B, and C in, just in case you guys wanted to do it. You might want to look at that before the final. Okay. Is this machine on my network? I don't know why I just don't use the Braille display. Oh, here we are. A router uses the logical AND operation to determine whether a machine exists on a network. A machine exists... keep scrolling. Thank you. Keep scrolling. Why isn't that scrolling down? An AND gate works as follows. Remember, we said that if both inputs to the AND gate are 1, then the output of the AND gate is 1. So if you've got a tap, a water supply and two taps, and both of the taps are on, then the kids are going to get wet under the sprinkler with the dog. Okay, so both inputs to the gate are a 1, the output is a 1. Kids and dog sold separately. So we end up with 0 and 0 is 0, 0 and 1 is 0, 1 and 0 is 0, 1 and 1 is 1. That is your truth table for an AND. Anyone got a problem with that?
Nope.
Okie dokie. Now what happens is the router ANDs the subnet mask with the destination IP address in order to get the network address. Remember, the network address is defined as the address on the network where all of the host bits are set to 0. So the network address on the network 192.168.1.0, subnet mask 255.255.255.0, is 192.168.1.0. Everyone cool with that? And there's a worked example if you're into that sort of thing. And it's a bit difficult with JAWS. In fact, for this sort of stuff, I'd recommend setting your number pronunciation to digits, because 11 million, 11 million, 11 million doesn't really make a lot of sense. There are also... that's certainly going to make life a bit easier. Some people do that for their notepad. You can actually change the settings specifically for notepad. Or if you're really concerned that you don't want to change the default for notepad, you could copy your notepad.exe to binpad.exe and then make a binpad script and a shortcut so that you wouldn't have to change the defaults for notepad. Seriously, I just changed the defaults for notepad, but that's just me, and then delete the settings file afterwards. If you have a Braille display, you will be even more of a happy camper. Anybody play with Jackie's notepad scripts? I expect Pranav would have. Anybody else drag them down and have a bit of a tinker?
I haven't. What do they do? I mean, admittedly, I'm not a regular JAWS user, but maybe I'm missing something.
Oh, the only difference is, and you can probably configure WindowEyes to do this, is when you cursor up and down, it just reads the character you land on rather than the whole line.
Yeah, I probably could. That's actually a really good idea. That would be nice.
Yeah. If you could somehow convince your screen reader of choice to only read the character you land on rather than the whole thing, it would cut down the verbiage when you're doing the calculations quite significantly. And that might be useful. Okay, now we're looking at the destination routing table, which Robert had some questions on. Let's talk about this, and then we'll see if people can complete the rest of the exercise between now and next week. Okay, the first destination is 192.168.1.0 with a subnet mask of 255.255.255.0. That is a Class C network on 192.168.1.0. Everybody happy with that?
Yep.
So we would all agree that packets destined to 192.168.1.5 and 192.168.227 and 192.168.1.40 and 192.168.1.105 and in fact 192.168.1.254 would all be destined for that network. Everybody cool with that?
Yes.
In other words, 192.168.1.anything is going to go to that network. Okay, so if the router says that the default gateway of those networks is 123.123.123.123, all packets destined to 192.168.1.0 will be forwarded to gateway 123.123.123.123. Okay, the next routing entry is 192.168.2.0. Subnet mask 255.255.255.128. Alright, I threw a spanner in the works. 255.255.255.128 means we have 25 bits for the network and 7 bits for the host. So, if we are looking at the network 192.168.2.0 and we only have 7 bits for the host, we have a network range that ranges from 1 to 126, with the network address being on 0 and the broadcast being on 127, which means Anything 192.168.2.1, 192.168.2.64, 192.168.2.126 will all go to 125.125.125.125. Everyone cool with that?
Yes.
Anything from 192.168.2.128 to 192.168.2.254 or 129 to 254 will go to 126.126.126.126. So we're all cool with that?
Makes sense.
Now all you have to do is figure out which network any of those IP addresses that I've listed below are on, and by figuring out which network they're on, and you can do that by taking the IP address and anding the subnet mask with them to get the network addresses, and then just look up the routing table and see which gateway those packets should be destined to. I've also told you to calculate the network addresses and broadcast addresses for those networks so that you can actually take a shortcut and see where the ranges of those networks actually take effect. And once you can see the upper and lower bound of the network, it should be easy to figure out where in that range of IP addresses each of those sample IP falls. Any questions? Anything people would like me to explain a bit more? Anything people would like me to talk about or elaborate on? Does that process theoretically make sense? If not, how have I managed to confuse you? If anybody has any specific questions, they can feel free to catch me on Skype or they can email me, and I will do my best to answer those questions via whichever your preferred medium is, and seeing if we can get you to understand how these routing tables work. Does everybody remember doing the route print from the command prompt a few weeks back and actually having a look at their Windows routing table? Well, this is exactly the same sort of table, and it's how your computer decides where packets that are outbound from your computer based on their destination IP address are going to be routed to. Now, did anybody have any problems with the, and for those of you who haven't looked at it yet, you'll get to look at it sometime this week, possibly. Anybody have trouble with the subnetting where we were slicing up the networks into different size chunks for our different requirements?
I actually like that part, because I think it's the most practical part of this whole thing.
Well, to be honest with you, the routing tables are used every day of the week, and without your routing table on your router, you'd never torrent anything.
And where would I be then? I'd be Linux 11.
So your router, your Linksys, whatever it is, actually has a routing table in it, and it does exactly what that previous exercise does. It maps your network addresses against the routes in the table and figures out which of the routes is appropriate for that particular network address and either forwards it out that interface or to that gateway.
So the router has a routing table.
Yes, it does. And in fact, if you go into the command line of your alternative firmware and type the command route, it will show you the routing table.
I'd hope to, and it would show you the routing table in the GUI. If not, that's kind of lazy.
Okie dokies. So, if anybody has any further questions about that, you can either ask here or you can ask me secretly so that everybody else doesn't have to know what question you had. And hopefully we'll see some completed versions of that exercise before next week, if possible. Alrighty. Now that we have talked about that stuff, has anybody else got any other pending questions before we go on to the physical layer? And yes, modifying a whole pile of labs to work on the remote bundles is on my list of things to do, although I don't think I'm going to be able to make the Eagle server externally accessible. It's too hard. Okie dokie. Chapter 8, the physical layer. The physical layer encodes signals into binary digit that encodes binary digits into signals that can travel over the network media. We have three types of network media: copper, fiber, and wireless. Has anyone not seen optical fiber?
Not in a network setting, although hopefully that will change in a few months.
Have you
cables, however.
Have you seen those silly light things with all the sticky up bits of fiber that shine the light up in all different colors and stuff? I can't remember what they're called.
I believe so.
Yeah, they use a sort of cruddy form of optical fiber. I just can't remember what they call them. Does anybody know those shiny light color things? No, not media converters. They're actually like an ornament that goes on your mantelpiece, and it shines the light up in all different colors. There's a light at the bottom and a whole stack of fibers, and then the light comes out the top.
I've got an optical cable for my PlayStation.
I thought that was an optical fountain or a light fountain.
Yeah, I think they are a light fountain. You can actually get Christmas trees made with optical fibers as well that, you know, no nasty branches and things that fall off. A lot of people are getting into the optical fiber Christmas trees. Okay.
That's pretty smart, actually.
Yeah, I always thought so. I was never a big fan of Christmas trees. Not because I have a problem with Christmas, but just because they made a mess all over the floor.
They do.
For the physical layer, you need the physical media and the associated connectors. How about that? A representation of bits on the media, encoding of data and control information, and you need transmitter and receiver circuitry on the network devices. Now, the media doesn't actually carry the frame. It carries, well, it does, but it actually carries the bits that make up the frame, because the frame is actually a layer 2 construct. Remember from layers 7, 6, 5, we have data. From layer 4, we have segments. From layer 3, we have packets. From layer 2, we have frames. And from layer 1, we have bits. Everybody remember that from a few weeks ago?
Yep.
Now, you can actually get media converters. Speaking of media converters, there's little devices that you plug in, and on one side of them they've got an RJ45, for example, and then on the other side they've got like a fibre port. So you can actually convert from RJ45 to fibre, and obviously at the other end back again. We'll talk about fibre a little bit later. Physical layer standards are set by engineers, such as ISO, Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers, ANSI, the American National Standards Institute, the International Telecommunications Union, the Electronics Industry Alliance, and the National Telecommunications Authority. You can tell I lifted a list of these from the notes. Hey, but that's what I'm trying to teach you, so I'm technically allowed to do that. There are four types of things that these engineer types tend to define. Physical and electrical properties of the media. Mechanical bits that relate to the connectors and the pinouts and those sorts of things, how they're all going to go together. Bit representation of the signals, how the encoding is going to work. And the definition of the control information signals. Any questions so far? Okay. Bits are encoded into a signaling standard before they go onto the media. And it allows the hardware to do things like error detection and to detect things like end of frame and stuff like that. I don't know whether anybody has ever played with serial cables, but generally in serial communications, you have often one start bit, 8 data bits, and 1 stop bit, which ends up with your characters being represented by 10 bits on the medium, but because it's asynchronous serial with the start and the stop bits, that will actually tell the UARTs where the bits start and end on the serial line.
I used to do this with serial modems and serial synthesizers. You used to use the mode command in DOS.
You did. You'd go mode space COM1 colon 9600 comma N comma 8 comma 1 comma P, and then you'd hit return, and then you'd fire up your screen reader of choice and pray. Or if you wanted to run an Arctic Transport in Accent emulation mode, you would actually have to go mode COM1 colon 9600 comma N comma 7 comma 1 comma P, and that would make things happy. Sorry, you were saying something, Conrad? I missed what you said.
No, I say I remember that from connecting my Braille Speak to my computer.
Yeah, a lot of people had Braille and Speaks and Braille, whatever the other ones that came after the Braille and Speaks. What was it? The
it was
Braille Light.
Speak and then Braille Light, and then the 2000
yep.
series.
Yep, yep. Does anybody remember having terrible trouble with those silly little DIN connectors that most blind people I knew could never line up?
I actually preferred the DIN connectors on the 2000s to the ones that were in the older ones, because those had, like, really floppy connectors that would, the pins would break in, like, 2 seconds.
It always amazed me, and maybe I'm just, in retrospect, maybe it was a bit expensive or something, but I always wondered why they didn't put an RJ45 or an RJ12 connector onto the actual Braille and speak rather than using the DIN. It would have been far more rugged and survived a lot more blind finger trouble.
Yeah, you mean just for terminal link? I assume this was back before they had integrated cards, because that's what they did for the Millennium series they put. Yeah, I think that was before most PCs had integrated modems as well.
Yeah, but I'm saying if you're going to make it a DIN connector, if you're going to make it a DIN connector on one end and a serial connector on the other end, and you're going to make it difficult for the users anyway, why not just make it an RJ45 on one end and then a serial port on the other, and then that way
you
just plug them straight in.
Their phones and not understood why it didn't work.
Yeah, this is true. This is quite probable. And then they'd have to protect against 48 volts when the phone was on hook.
Yeah.
Anyway. A friend of mine actually sliced the serial cable off the back of his Double Talk LT and put an RJ45 connector on the back of it, and actually did wire up that cable because it was just easier than... and easy to replace the cables when things broke. Okay, the sender and receiver must be synchronized using a clocking signal, or use transitions to show when clock pulses occur, and we'll talk about this in a minute. Now, amplitude, phase, and frequency can be changed in the signal, and they are the three characteristics that you can mess with if you're sending a signal over physical media. Now, you can actually use transitions to see when the signal is actually changing on the media. One of the problems is a lot of people think that, say, for example, a 1 is going to be 3 volts and a 0 is going to be 0 volts. One of the problems with this signaling standard is that if a 1 is 3 volts and a 0 is 0 volts, if the cable isn't plugged in, you're going to get a constant stream of zeros. And how do you actually tell where one bit begins and where one bit ends? So what you actually do is you... actually change the signal from one state to another, and it depends on which way the state changes in the time period as to whether you see a 0 or a 1.
What do you mean by a state? What are you changing?
Well, you change from 0 to 3 volts or 3 to 0 volts, and the direction of the change in the time period actually says whether you're seeing a 0 or a 1.
Okay. So what component do you use to change voltage? Are you saying you're using a transformer of some kind?
Or a transistor. A transistor array to flick voltage on and off. You don't tend to use a transformer. You'd probably use switching transistors.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Now, if anybody really wants to know how Manchester encoding works, you'll have to ask Ian, because I still don't quite get it. It's quite complex. But there are examples in the notes. I don't think they test you on it, so it's all good. The other person you could ask is Mr. Taylor, who might be on Friday Social. Okay, Ethernet, for example, you have a preamble, and you also have end-of-frame markers. So, for example, with the Ethernet, it actually sends 62 bits of 0-1, or 31 pairs of 0-1, followed by 1-1, and then that is the 64-bit preamble of Ethernet, and that is how, on the old coaxial versions of Ethernet, you knew when the start of the packet was. Basically, what you can do is you can mess around with the bit patterns so that you can recode them into another set of symbols, and then the symbols that you re-encode them into then shows where the start and end of frame stuff is. It has various control sequences, and then it also has the data codes. Has everybody Has anybody ever wondered, and you probably haven't, and it's okay if you haven't, has anybody ever wondered how data compression works?
Oh, yes. And yeah. I sort of
I
read
have a
about
vague idea, I believe.
In the ARJ manual once upon a time.
That's going back a ways.
Yeah, how I understand it, it takes a number of the bits that are the same, and then rather than represents it by a couple of bytes saying this character and this many characters from this character are this character.
Well, there's a couple of different ways of doing it. One of it is to actually use a lookup dictionary, and you basically build a list of character prefixes, and then you index back into the dictionary to say how far the character is, so you can actually go, oh no, you're actually looking, you know, 307 bits back in the dictionary for this code symbol. The other way they do it is if you look at the squeezing algorithm, which is really going back a long time, for those of you who used to use CPM, there was a utility called squeeze, and it would replace the middle character of the extension of a file name with a Q. Is anybody old enough to remember that one? So EXE became EQE and COM became CQM?
I think that's vaguely familiar.
Well, basically what it would do is it would actually count all of the characters in the file. It would then calculate the frequency of all the characters, and it would then build a binary tree assigning the shortest binary codes to the most common characters, followed by the longer binary codes to the characters that became less and less common. And it was invented by... it was invented back in the 50s, I think. And basically, it had short codes for the most common characters and long codes for the least common characters. And you could see about 20 to 30% savings in file size if you actually did this squeezing. It wasn't particularly efficient because you had to run through the files twice, one to count the number of every character and then the second time to actually encode it. But it didn't take a lot of memory. You only had to sort of send the tree along with the file, and it was a method of compression that would work on very small architecture systems. Now, the only reason I mention this is because we're talking about code groups, and that was some way of recoding data into different symbols to reduce the amount of space they take up.
Okay, you've got me curious now. When you're talking about all this switching, recoding, and so on, this is happening at the bit level, right? With the actual physical layer. Now, an electron is an electron is an electron. I have the same set of particles flowing across the media. So how does the recoding actually work? Is it all down to timing?
Well, it's down to timing and whether or not the current is flowing. So if you're actually seeing a voltage at a given time, and depending on what that voltage that you see is, will depend on what's theoretically coming through the media. Now, it's not as easy as, you know, 5 volts for a 1 and 0 volts for a 0. In fact, on serial, I think they use 5 volts for a 1 and minus 5 volts for a 0, and it actually, 0 volts is undefined. So you actually have to see a voltage on the cable to actually be sending things.
Just a sec, again. Voltage is potential difference between two terminals, right? And the amperage would dictate the amount of current that would flow. So are you saying that you're changing the potential energy, or what? What's going on?
Essentially, in these circuits, you are basically using transistors to switch on and off a particular voltage. The current is limited to whatever the cable can take, usually, you know, a few milliamps, because you don't actually need a lot of current to actually travel. So essentially, you're using, in the case of serial, you've got a chip called a universal asynchronous receiver transmitter, and it is a chip that is responsible for flicking these voltages on and off and backwards and forwards. So in one side of the chip you put in binary data, and then out the other side of the chip on the data lines on the cable, it actually twiddles the voltage in the standard so that the voltages on the cable change So that the other UART at the other end can pick up those voltage changes and then convert them back into binary coming off on the other side of the circuit board.
So is there some kind of switching table that tells us on a chip, like a routing table, you know, how much to switch to and what voltage to switch on and off?
Well, that's built into the UART itself, and the UART is programmed to know how to switch these things backwards and forwards. So if it sees 8 bits on its data inputs, it then does, it has a clock, and you'll be interested to know that generally speaking on a regular serial line, and I'm not talking about modems, that the clock rate of the serial line is usually equal to the baud rate. Or it's a divisor of a particular clock, a master clock signal, and then you divide that to get your baud rate. So obviously the higher the baud rate, the higher the clock speed. So if you're sending it at 1,200 bits per second, the clocking will be slower than if you're sending it 9,600 bits per second. And basically the UART uses the clock and it flicks the bits backwards and forwards in the necessary patterns of voltage based on that clocking signal until it has sent all of the 8 bits that it's on its input side. That's a very simplistic view. Modern UARTs do have FIFOs, so you can actually fill them up with 16 bytes, and they will go through and clock out those 16 bytes so that you don't need to generate an interrupt for every character that you send.
I've played with this somewhere. I forget where, but I have... I used to have a program on my 386 to switch on and off the UART. I don't know why they wanted that, but it used to be there. So what governs the speed again of data? You're saying, is it this clock that we're discussing, like fiber can go gigabit speed, so is it a faster clock and the media capacity to hold, you know, that much amount of current, or what else?
Well, you've got to understand that when you're actually changing voltages or changing light patterns and stuff, there is actually a time taken for those voltages to change. And the way the voltages change, they don't just flick straight on and off. It's not sort of an instant on-off thing that sort of shifts and fades and gets bigger and stuff. So you've got to allow for bit skew and the amount of time that it's going to take for those voltages to actually change. And you basically have a clock on either end of the circuit, generally speaking, and the speed at which those clocks run, and they're usually a crystal, usually a quartz crystal or similar, and the quartz crystal is exposed to X-rays until it vibrates at approximately the correct frequency, generally speaking. But yeah, that clocking circuit actually is what keeps everything in sync, and you get different clocking circuits depending on what sort of media you're looking at. And if you look on a network card, I'm not sure about the modern ones because they tend to integrate it, but with the older ones you will see a 4-pin metal box that is actually the clocking chip. And generally speaking on 10 megabit Ethernet cards, the clock would run at 20 megahertz.
Okay, that's interesting.
It's actually more efficient to run a clock at twice the speed that it needs to go at and actually have a divisor than it is to actually have a clock that runs at exactly the same speed as what you want. Okay, the code groups can reduce bit level error, limiting the effective energy transmitted into the media, helping distinguish between data bits and control bits, better media error detection, and in certain situations it can actually limit the amount of energy used. And the one they cite in the notes is if you are using optical fiber and if a 1 was when the light was on and a 0 was when the light was off, you could actually burn out the laser diode if you sent thousands and thousands and thousands of 1s, because the laser would be on all the time and it could potentially overheat. Okay, there are 3 measures of how fast data can flow on a particular medium. You have a bandwidth, and we have analog bandwidth, which is usually measured in kilohertz or megahertz, which is sort of how much waveform you can get across a cable. You have digital bandwidth, which is measured in bits per second. You have throughput, which is how much data you get across the cable in a given time at a particular speed. And I think you all did an exercise on that back in one of the three labs where you did your recording of your Windows media file and worked out how long it would take to transmit. And then good put is how much data you actually get through the network once you take into consideration protocol overheads and all of the other stuff. So it's actually the speed at which the user sees data come down, which is generally speaking what you see if you measure your internet connection with one of those speed tests that I that you see out on the net, which is specifically there so that you can ring up your internet service provider and complain about how slow your stuff is coming down. It now, the analog bandwidth depends on the limits of the media, and as Scotty said in Star Trek, you cannot change the laws of physics, so the laws of physics are important as to how much data you can get over a cable, how quickly you can do it, and what distances you're going to send it. There are various standards and lengths written in your notes. For example, you cannot run a standard Category 5 cable more than 100 meters or 328 feet. And in fact, with higher bandwidths such as 10 gig Ethernet, I think the limit's down around 20 meters, 25 meters actually. I'd actually have to look that up. There are, however, some fiber, especially single mode fiber, that you can run up to 70 kilometers, which is quite a long way. There are various connectors on copper cables. You're looking at RJ11, RJ12, RJ45. On coax, you've got things like the BNC connector, you've got the N connector, and you've got the F connector. Any questions so far? Cables, copper cables can be interfered with by noise. You're looking at noise such as generated from electric motors, fluorescent lights, electromagnetic interference, all of those sorts of things. For anybody who was in ITE1 last week, we spoke about the value of having a little cheap AM radio that you can sit near your computer, and once you tune it in to somewhere that isn't the cricket or another radio station, you can listen to all the pops and clicks and stuff that are generated by the computer and see whether the computer is still busy or whether it is frozen up. Has it ever occurred to anybody that the reason computers have a metal box is not only to protect you from the voltages and stuff inside the power supply and stuff, but also to limit the effect of electromagnetic interference? Has anybody done the put the radio trick near their computer? It's kind of cool.
It's been a while. Here in the U.S., we have some rules. The FCC has rules. If you've seen cords with those big kind of round cylinders kind of toward the ends, those are toroids, and those are supposed to cut down on electromagnetic interference. Because if your computer puts out too much signals and your neighbor's TV gets a problem, the Federal Communications Commission is legally empowered to come and do bad things to you.
This is certainly true. And in fact, one of the problems we used to have when I used to do citizen band radio was when you'd fire up on CB radio, you would interfere with everybody's TV. And it wasn't the fact that your radio was actually bleeding over onto frequencies that it shouldn't. It was the fact that the TV was 20 or 30 years old. And often the problem could be solved by giving your neighbors a high-pass filter, which they would then put on their television, and all of a sudden the interference would go away. Now, there are limits. I believe, I usually get these around the wrong way. Class A is the limits for a commercial installation, and Class B is for home use. Does that sound right, or have I got them around the wrong way?
No, that's correct.
What that really means is that it's still going to interfere with stuff. It's probably not going to interfere with stuff as badly as it would if there weren't any regulations. Actually, I don't know whether anybody's ever been guilty of this, but I'll put my hand up for doing it. Has anybody jumped on eBay and bought a cheap switch mode plug pack replacement for one of their devices?
I am using at the moment a netbook charger that I bought for $10 on eBay.
Ages ago,
it
yes.
It generates lots of RF noise.
Yes, one of the side effects of these, and Mr. Taylor could talk about this more specifically, one of the things you need to be aware of is that apparently there isn't a lot of filtering between you and the AC. They don't bother with all of those capacitors and stuff because that just adds expense. So they've got the minimum number of components necessary, and then they put it into a little plastic box that I'm sure if you drop it on the hard floor the wrong way more than three times will split open. Maybe yours is better than mine, but I'm talking about mine.
Okay, question.
Mm. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry, you had a question, Pranav? Okay, is anybody else still here? Pranav has seemed to have had a technical difficulty.
I'm still here.
I don't know if you can hear me.
Yeah, we can hear you. Hello, Grace. Grace even sneaked in without rattling her keys.
Grace.
It was incredible. Yeah, Grace is here. Yes, my gorgeous other half. Okay. So when Pranav gets his stuff sorted, he can ask me his question and I will stop talking, which is very rare. Okay, but anyway, there isn't a lot of filtering between you and these cheap chargers. And one of the things I noticed about these cheap chargers, which was quite disturbing, is I have one for my EEPC 1000H. Okay. And,
oh.
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, I did. The metal...
Yes, the metal is meant to act as a Faraday cage. Ah, okay. I'm showing a ping of 77 milliseconds here, so I'm not sure whether you're having actually 86 milliseconds at the moment. So maybe you're seeing more latency than me. I'll just shut up for a minute and we'll see if it settles down. Is anybody else seeing unusual latency? There you go.
Ah, okay. I always think it's a good conductor.
Yeah, the metal is a good conductor. However, the case is actually grounded. So, and because it's isolated from the other things inside the computer and the case is grounded, any sorts of unwanted potentials and stuff will be grounded out somewhat safely rather than going into you. Where's Carol? Okay. Which means if Shani's not stacked somewhere reasonable, she can shift over to where Carol is or whatever if we run out of space. Yeah, so you get these cheap chargers and they work fairly well. Although one of the things I noticed with mine is that when you plug it into the EEPC and you touch any of the VGA connectors or the USB connectors, you get this lovely little tingling in your fingers, which is somewhat disturbing, and for that reason I would tend to recommend to people that they possibly buy the slightly more expensive charger. I think there isn't an earth connection and you do sort of get potential differences, and in fact I had a USB cable in one hand which was connected to a power supply and I had the netbook on charge and I touched the VGA connector and I got belted with quite a nasty voltage. So I took the netbook off charge and put its real charger back onto it because that was all a bit dangerous and I didn't want to be... Yeah, you do see it in a lot of badly constructed offices, and there are some cases where people have wired active and neutral around the wrong way and all sorts of other nastiness. In Australia we have active, neutral and earth, and I think in modern installations over there in the States you guys are starting to see an earth pin as well. Historically you used to see just two holes in the wall a long time ago and they had no earth pin at all, which was... Yeah, a lot of places do, and they tend to have earth. A lot of people do have the earth wire. Anyway,
we've had 3-point circuits in the U.S. Our plugs have a big round prong on them, which is earth ground, and we've had that since late 60s.
Okay. The people I was speaking to had been to the U.S. a long time ago. Okay, so that was all a bit of a digression, but essentially the twisting of the wires can limit the noise, because when you twist the when electricity travels along a wire, it, especially alternating current, generates a circular magnetic field around the wire, and if you have the pairs twisted around each other and the current goes down one pair, down one wire one way and up the other wire the other way, those two magnetic fields can cancel each other out and can also aid in shielding the circuit from the rest of the interference that it might actually come into contact with. You've got various categories of twisted pair, 3, 4, 5 and 6. If you're installing category 3 twisted pair in 2010, you are probably not going to be somebody I'll employ to do my cabling. I would be saying that you would want to be installing at least Cat 5e or Cat 6 in new installations. Cat 5 being is what is required for 100 megabit Ethernet, and Cat 5e being the minimum requirement for gigabit with Cat 6 preferred. The categories have a different number of twists per meter, and in the case of Cat 6, they actually have a separating insulator in the middle of the cable to cut down on crosstalk. Or crow's talk, if you're using JAWS. So you might want to put that in your dictionary. If you install the cheap cable, like the Category 3, and then the boss says he wants gigabit because YouTube just isn't running nicely on his workstation, you may have to recable the whole building, and that can be quite expensive. There are three broad different types of RJ45 cables. One is a straight-through network cable, one is a crossover network cable, and one is a rollover. A straight-through being used to connect a workstation to a switch hub or router. A crossover used to connect workstation to workstation or router to router. And a rollover being used as a serial connection for Cisco equipment. A lot of devices these days will auto-detect whether you're using crossover or straight through cables, but Murphy's Law dictates that you will come across one that won't when you only have a crossover cable handy. If you are vision impaired, you get somebody sighted to look at the ends and they tell you which colours are where, and based on where the colours are, if the same colours are on pins 1 and 2, 3 and 6 on both ends, then it is a straight through cable. If the colours on 1 and 2 are actually mapped to 3 and 6 on the other end of the cable, then it is actually a crossover cable.
Okay, so I've had this experience where I bought some LAN cables and I got a straight cable instead of, I think I got a cross cable instead of straight cable or something like that. Now, where are the pins in the RJ45? Sorry, fundamental question. Are you expecting me to remove the RJ45 adapter?
No. The actual RJ45s are transparent. You can actually see through them, and you can actually see what coloured wires are actually running to the pins. So if you look at the actual connector, you can actually see what colours are running through. And pin 1 is on the left-hand side with the tip facing, the retaining lever facing downwards. And that is how you find out where pin 1 is, as if you were going to plug the cable into your mouth, which you shouldn't do, of course.
Ah, okay. Okay.
Are you signed in, Grace, or not? Okay. No, I was just asking. Yeah, Ventrilo.
Oh, no.
Oh. Oh, well, you are theoretically doing this class, but anywho. Okay. With coaxial inner core, you have the inner core, you have the insulation, you then have the braiding, which is the return path for the connector, for the signal, and then you have the outer jacket, which is usually made of PVC or something similar. Everybody should have seen coax somewhere, either running from your television to the wall, or if you've got one of those old coax networks, or perhaps you've done some RF work and seen coax. It's often used for carrying wireless signals, that is so that the wireless signals don't fly off the cables and become antennas where they shouldn't. In fact, you tend to use LN400 coax on 802.11 wireless networks. The cable TV companies are using HFC, which is hybrid fiber coax, which means that the last mile, or in other words, the bit into your living room, is coaxial. However, the connection to the box that comes to your house is fiber. Shielded twisted pair is like normal twisted pair. Except there, all of the four pairs are actually wrapped in an outer foil jacket. It tends to be less flexible and more expensive than the unshielded twisted pair. And it is used to, it is more resistant to RF interference. You've got to watch out with copper cable because you can get nasty voltages, especially if you run it too close to power cables and sort of that. So you shouldn't run your network cables close to your power cables. There should be a certain amount of separation between the network and the power cables in the cable conduit. Yes, people have run them right next to each other. Not very sensible. There are regulations that are meant to protect equipment and people. You shouldn't run lots of copper cable externally to buildings because you can get potential from lightning strikes and those sorts of things, which can be very dangerous to your equipment and possibly to people. I actually once... Has anybody ever had their modem hit by lightning? I had mine hit by lightning.
I have.
I had mine hit by lightning. In fact, my hand was about 6 inches away from the modem, and then there was this incredible bang of fizz, and then an incredible bang of thunder, and no more modem.
You're lucky you still had a hand in a computer.
Well, luckily it was an external modem, and I hadn't quite gotten over to it because I was going over to it to unplug it, and it got hit by lightning before I could do so. Okay, insulation can cause problems if burnt or heated. You've got to check the codes on this. In fact, I believe in certain situations, cable that is running between floors needs to be made of an insulation that is not going to be a problem when fire gets to it and stuff, because it can often be the poisonous fumes that can be released from heating the PVC and stuff that can actually kill people more than the actual fire will, which is a bit disturbing. Okay, fiber uses...
Here in the U.S., we have plenum cable for use between floors, and it's the insulation on it is made out of Teflon. And then there's other cable, the R cable, which is PVC insulation on the outside. And the R cable can be used in, but it has to be used in metal conduits if it's to be run around. Yeah, and you're right, there are some increasingly tough code regulations for how that stuff is used.
Absolutely. I mean, PVC is cheap and in some instances rather nasty. They do talk about plenum cabling in the old version of ITE1. We don't talk about it anymore. It is important, and if you are doing cabling, you obviously need to be licensed and you need to know all this stuff. Okay, fiber uses light and does not conduct electricity very well because it's made of glass. It has high bandwidth and can go over long distances. Depending on the standards, and with single mode fiber, which uses laser down a very fine 9 micron in diameter glass fiber, you can actually shoot a laser beam 70 kilometers, which is quite a distance. You need different skills for handling fiber. It's more expensive per meter than copper. However, its expandability and its bandwidth is incredibly high. Generally, if somebody is going to run fiber, they don't tend to run two fibers, especially if they're doing it on a large commercial scale. They will tend to run 50 or 100 or 200 fibers and just leave the ones that they're not using dark, so that when they do want to use them, they can just wire up the ends and away they go.
Is it true that you can't have a join in fiber cables? They have to be single pieces?
You can have a join. However, if you are going to join fiber cables, you need to sand the edges completely flat, and you need to make sure that the edges touch exactly with special equipment so that you can make sure that the join is as good as possible, because you can lose light at the join points. Do not look into the far end of an active fiber. It can burn your eyeballs out. It is infrared, and if it's an infrared laser, it will burn tiny little holes in your retina. Ouch. Don't do it. Single-mode fiber uses lasers. Multi-mode fiber just uses regular, unfocused, non-coherent infrared light, which bounces around the fiber but does eventually get down to the other end, which is why it can't go as far as lasers, because with a laser you shoot it straight down the fiber and you get it further distances. This means that you have to be very careful how much you bend fiber and on what angles you run fiber, because if you bend it too acutely, the light can't travel down it, and you generally have to run it in as straight a lines as possible, unless you have amplifiers and repeaters. Okay, wireless media can travel through air and can be interfered with. We've talked about a lot about this. Various wireless standards, 802.15 is Bluetooth, 802.1 BANG, or BANG, are the different wireless LAN standards. You also have things like GPRS, and you also have your 2G and 3G mobile data and your GPRS connections, which I believe are very popular in India, of all places. Every time I go looking up AT command sequences for Hayes modems, there's some Indian guy that's written a page up. So is it very popular over there? Okay, security is important on wireless networks, obviously, otherwise people can hack in, and because it's going over the air, people can intercept the signals and decrypt them. Wireless LANs have stations and access points. The access points are the devices that take care of the CSMA/CA protocol, or the carrier sense multiple access with collision avoidance, and they regulate the traffic that is travelling across the wireless network in order that people can, the stations can all cooperate. Security is paramount, but the fact that you can move stuff around and you're not running any cables is kind of cool. Any questions? That's all we have today. All right, guys. I'm about to hit stop.